You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
In the early 1990s, Ken Liotier was making money as a binner, going through garbage looking for recyclable and reusable containers. At the time, it was hard to find somewhere to return cans and bottles for money, so Ken and some of his friends created the recycling depot, United We Can. The depot on Hastings Street currently accepts containers from an average of 700 binners each day. Revenue from these activities is used to create work for people who face multiple barriers to employment. This work includes employment in the depot, as well as in United We Can's other enterprises, such as a bicycle recycle and repair shop and a street cleaning crew. Ken Liotier was asked to give the first annual Jim Green Memorial Lecture. Jim Green was an organizer with the Downtown Eastside Residents Association in the 1980s and a champion of low-cost housing in the Downtown Eastside. Jim Green died on February 28th last year. We're going to bring you some excerpts now from Ken Liotier's talk. We're going to join his presentation as he talks about his early life in North Vancouver.
My own story, as was mentioned, I was born in North Vancouver, and don't hold that against me, because when I was born, North Vancouver was very working class, and certainly my family was very working class. And some of my earliest remembrances were coming over to the Vancouver Public Library, which in those days was at the Carnegie. And that might be dating me. I mean, I was born in 1947. There's no problem with sharing that. It was just after the war. And as a matter of fact, on my birth certificate, there was ration coupons attached for milk. So I gather that rationing was still going on in 1947. And people were just sort of regrouping and trying to figure out how to put lives back together and get on with them. This was a time before television, and people listened to the radio and went to movies. I checked, and the best movie that year, I checked it online the year in 1947, was Gentleman's Agreement. It was a dramatic social commentary on anti-Semitism. And I gather that just after the war like that, that was a big topic. And those issues were big topics in my home as well. My recollection is that the chatter was about the war and about the Great Depression that had preceded the war, and my parents were children of that time. I remember my father driving an old 1930-something Chrysler. It was one of those sort of square jobs, and we would come over the Lionsgate Bridge to the Carnegie Library, and he'd park it outside. And I have vague sort of fractured remembrances of the worn faces of men on the street in and around the Carnegie, people with missing limbs. Poverty was beginning to become visible on the streets in this part of the city even then. And you know, it's interesting, years later, when the Carnegie, that had been shut down for a number of years, reopened as the Carnegie Community Center in the 1980s, the first time I walked up that spiral staircase, my legs remembered the marble steps, that if you walk up, you'll see how they've been worn out. And as I walked up, my legs remembered it. That was a pre-verbal memory, a very strange sort of effect on me. It was just like, oh, I know this. But I wouldn't have been able to describe it except to feel it. And anyway, just a just sort of an interesting experience for me. I guess I had an idyllic kind of childhood. I grew up in Lynn Valley in North Van, close to Lynn Canyon. My brother and I would go swimming in the canyon, and it was a pretty carefree life in many, many respects. In my teenage years, I got hit with a disease called Crohn's disease, and I got very, very sick. And it became a real challenge for me to continue on. I had many long stays in hospital, and between hospital and trying to hold work and stumbling attempts to further my education, I had a hard time. I did manage in the late 60s to get work in the Vancouver Land Titles Office, and I learned about real estate and how real estate transfers happened and how conveyancing worked and how subdivisions were created. And I learned enough there that I had something that I could sell. I had a labor to sell. And as a result of that, I found work in the real estate industry. I ended up working at Marathon Realty in the 70s. I did technical services and subdivision planning. At the time, Gordon Campbell was also working at Marathon Realty, and Art Phillips was the mayor. Pierre Trudeau was the prime minister. And we had a new NDP premier, Dave Barrett, the first NDP premier. Along the way, I also discovered alcohol and drugs and the Balmoral Hotel beer parlor, which turned out to be open on Christmas Day. And that, for me, was, like, profound. There was also a late-night liquor store up just east of Main on Hastings, where Garlane's Pharmacy is now, and I used to be able to snag liquor there. And I continued to be sick and got sicker, probably as a result of the drinking and drugging that I was doing. I maintained an average weight of around 115 pounds and had chronic diarrhea and nausea and blood loss and lots of pain. By 1978, I was essentially too sick to hold down a full-time job. I had virtually no social life apart from drinking in beer parlors, and mostly I drank alone. I'm sharing all of this not for any sort of sympathy vote, but just like it's a fact of how I arrived in the downtown East Side. So I think that it's important to know that many of the folks that are my friends and neighbors in the downtown East Side arrived here for all kinds of real circumstances. And there's been some very interesting work done recently by psychiatrists exploring the circumstances of people living in SROs in the downtown East Side. And the information that's coming out, though probably not new, is so comprehensive that it's startling and profound. And I really would urge anybody that's at all interested to get in touch with these folks. But very interesting information. Several of the pieces of the information that they have shared, they looked at 300 people, 300 residents in the SROs. They've extrapolated out that this would mean 8 out of 10 people living in a hallway across the SROs in the downtown East Side. The mortality rate for people living in our SROs is not double the national average. It's 5 times the national average. That's a startling sort of statistic when one thinks of it. They looked at multiple morbidity. They looked at 12 different kinds of illnesses and conditions that people in the downtown East Side suffer from. No one in their study had less than 3. This group of researchers are not sort of, at this point anyway, proposing treatment or solutions. They're just assessing conditions. Anyway, I kind of gone off on a tangent here, but the point I was trying to make is that we get here for reasons, and when I heard this information, I thought, well, yeah, I kind of know that, but no bloody wonder. And, you know, people say, why the hell are people living in those SROs in the downtown East Side, and why don't they just pull up their socks and get out there and get a job? Well, you know, as you start to find out the circumstances of many of us, there's other reasons. The other thing that happened for me when I heard that study, and it was only came out recently, is that initially I thought, oh yeah, I can kind of know who these people are. By the time I got home, and I was quite moved about that, by the time I got home, I realized this was a study about me as well, that I was a part of that. And up to that point, I had to really just examine that it wasn't just those folks objectified out there, it was me included in. Quite a powerful thing to come to understand. And actually, in putting this together for tonight, because over the years I've been recognized for efforts that I've put in, and I've sensed a sort of a gulf has been created between where I thought I was initially and where I thought I got to. In putting this together, I realized just how severely broken I am and was and continue to be, and I think it's probably important to sort of see that in a better perspective. Anyway, my illness was pretty debilitating and isolating, and perhaps in part because of my own character. I've never had anything remotely like a committed personal relationship. That's a kind of a personal statement, but it's a fact also of my life. So much of my earlier life was lost. I mean, I was kind of lost and sick, and I didn't have a good sense of how to connect in this world. And I didn't even know that I didn't have a good sense of that. I just sort of went through it and did my life, you know. I recognized that I had an addiction problem. I didn't call it an addiction problem, but I just had this affinity for booze and drugs. And I recognized it as a problem in the 70s, and I went for help, and I met others who were finding a way through that. But even there, at that point in time, I didn't feel close to people. I was quite alienated and disconnected. Anyway, it was an ongoing struggle.
We're listening to some excerpts from the first Jim Green Memorial Lecture given by Ken Liotier. Ken Liotier is a founder of United We Can, a successful recycling depot for binners in the downtown East Side. In this next segment, he talks about the changes that started to happen in the downtown East Side in the mid-1970s, and about how he came to find a sense of community in an area that at that time was known as Skid Row.
I first began hearing about change happening in what was then called Skid Row in the mid-1970s, and it wasn't initially about DERA. It was about a couple anti-poverty activists and advocates named Libby Davies and Bruce Erickson. Articles began appearing in the news about calls for improvement in the welfare rates and calls for the city to address some of the slumlords and the housing conditions in the old hotels. In the late 70s, actually in 1978, I got a little part-time job working in the downtown East Side Health Clinic, which used to be next to where the sisters hand out the sandwiches. And it was in the place that's called The Door Is Open, but it was the health clinic in those days. And they had a little food store, and I got a part-time job working in that food store. On the first morning I went for an interview, I was asked by one of the fellows that I recognized from the beer parlors. I was invited by him to come for breakfast after the interview at a friend of his named Margaret. And I was kind of reluctant. I didn't know this Margaret woman, and he said, no, it will be fine, just come along and she'll be happy to have us for breakfast. And after the interview, we left the health clinic through the lane wayside, he started going across the lane to what was called the New World Hotel. It's on the corner of Dunleavy and Powell, he went to a little door that I don't think was as tall as I am, and When I saw this little door, I thought, gee, you know, does Margaret live here? I don't think I really want to impose or go in there. No, 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 he said. He took me by the arm. As he started to pull me in, the door opened, and we went down a couple steps into what turned out to be a soup kitchen. And it was Mark Chisholm's New Hope Center, I came to know later on. I didn't realize at the time. I'd never been to such a place. And I'd seen people standing in lineups at soup kitchens going through the downtown east side, but I'd not sort of clued into what that would be about. I kind of wondered why people would be doing that. But there I was in the middle of it, amid people jammed together at narrow tables, not maybe as wide as this, and having soup. And Marg Chisholm was beside a great huge pot in her red sweater and smock, and she was ladling out the soup, and we sat down, and I thought, boy, this is a little bit edgy for me. People were there with their cut crutches and rags and scabs and grizzly beards, and it seemed kind of rough, and I sat there. They had crusts of bread in a basket on the table. They came around with the soup. I said, no thanks. I took a crust of bread and I started to chew on it. And I got high. I got psychedelically high. And I was startled by that. I didn't know what was happening. I didn't understand it. But it was potent. Initially, I thought maybe there was something in the bread. Then I realized, no, there was something happening. I was feeling something. And then they brought around more soup. And I said, well, maybe I will have some soup. And they said, well, there's only one bowl. And I said, well, I haven't had any bowls. And they said, so they gave me the soup, and I had the soup. And it was a very powerful experience, but I didn't understand what it was. And I left. And I decided I wanted to go back and experience that again the next day. I went to that little door in the back lane again the next day, and I went to go in. There was a security person there. They said, no, you can't go in this way. You have to go around and line up with everybody. Didn't know. I went and lined up, went through the lineup, and before I got to get in for the soup, they ran out of soup, so I didn't get a chance to go there again. But it was the first time in my adult life, maybe since family as a kid, that I was a part of a community. And I didn't even know what I was missing, you know. It was a place where I guess I was kind of accepted, where I could fit in, where I belonged, that nobody said, you can't be here. And I didn't even know that's what that was, you know. So we learn. I continued to work in real estate during that time, and at the end of the 70s, for those that can remember, it was, like so often is the case, the real estate market booms and busts, and it was getting ready to bust, and I was very, very sick, the dying kind of sick, and I saw a doctor in the health clinic, and he said, I think I know a doctor in Victoria that might be able to do something for you, and I went to Victoria to see the doctor. He couldn't do something for me, but I moved to Victoria in hope, eh? As it was, I stayed in Victoria for a year and collapsed in front of the hospital at some point along the way. They got me in, cut me up, and sent me out revived without my guts. And so I've lived since then with a bag on my side, an ostomy, and I've navigated along. But as soon as I was back on my feet, I wanted to get back to the downtown east side. In later years, I heard somebody, a friend actually, comment that the downtown east side draws people back like moths to a flame, and I think he was referring to the addiction and the cycle here. And I certainly was drawn back. I wasn't drawn back, though, for the booze and the drugs. I was drawn back because I wanted to experience more of what happened at that soup kitchen. I didn't understand it, but I knew that there was something there, you know. And I bounced around, in fact, from hotel to hotel and rooming house to rooming house, and ended up on the streets of the downtown east side, and used to sleep at the foot of Main Street. It was before the Main Street overpass was built, and beside the railway tracks was a place that you could sort of get in some shelter, and so I would hang up there. One day I used to go to the Dugout, which is a drop-in center in the downtown east side, at the time, my shoes were literally falling off my feet, and I went there. I was in a bad way, but I didn't know how bad a way I was, I guess. And there was a fellow there. His name was Bill Hennessy. There's now a housing project that's been named after him. And he was an advocate at First United Church, and he said, you know, I think I could probably find you a better pair of shoes than what you're wearing. If you come with me, maybe we can see what we can do. And I did. I followed him up to First United Church. And when I got there, I waited while he went to find some shoes. And while I was waiting, I heard people talking in the office about how they were going to be tearing down the church and building a housing project. And I heard this, and I said, really? You're going to tear down this church? And they said, yeah, that's our plan. We're going to pull down the church and build housing here. And I said, wow, is that ever neat? I'll bring my sledgehammer. I'm ready. Let me know, right? One of the people said to me, well, if you're really interested in helping out with this, actually we have some work here. And maybe you can get a job. And I thought, wow, that would be so good. So I went for an interview for that, and I did get a job working for First United Church Social Housing Society. The person that had hired me, his name was Lawrence Bantleman, and Lawrence Bantleman was a community developer par excellence, in my opinion. He was a total drunk, but a brilliant drunk, and the federal government had a social housing program, and they provided subsidies for development of non-market housing. Cooperatives and not-for-profit rentals. It was the 56-1 program under CMHC, and First United Church was looking at how they could get some of those unit allocations and turn the church into a housing project. And it was really my introduction to community development work, I guess. The project that I was working on was a job development program of the federal government, funded by the federal government, called the Canada Community Development Program, CCDP. It looked like one of those Soviet Union sort of labels, you know, and I felt like very sort of part of it, eh? So I'm so arrogant, God. Anyway, our job was to go and assess all the hotels and the rooms in the hotels and the residents in the hotels and gather all sorts of information and put it together. And in the process, promote the 56-1 program for other groups in the community that they too could sort of access those allocations and start building. There were very few public housing units in the community at that time. There was Raymier, a huge project, and there was McLean Park, and there were a couple of the lodges, Rodin and Oppenheimer, and but that was essentially it. So, you know, all the social housing that's come on since then, if one thinks about it and sort of goes around the downtown east side, there are so many units of housing, in spite of the fact that it's never enough. There has been a lot done over the last 30 years in terms of development of housing. So one of the things we had to do was go and knock on doors of other groups. And this was when I met Jim for the first time. He had just become the coordinator or the organizer for DERA, and he was working out of offices in the Ford building. And he was very intimidating. And frankly, totally dismissive of any idea of doing social housing. Apparently, when Libby and Bruce were more engaged at DERA, they tried to get hold of the Stratford Hotel, one of the hotels with a notorious bar in the downtown east side, and turn it into something that would be more stable and better representation of what they were calling for in terms of social housing. But it hadn't worked, and they'd been burned in the process. So they were kind of negative about it. And Jim had a lot on his plate, frankly. At the time, there was a lot going on. BC Place was being developed, and there were plans to do Expo, though it was still relatively early days, and he had Canada Community Development projects of his own that he was managing, and they were looking at cooking wine and knives and a whole array of other things. So housing just did not seem to be on the radar. At the same time, at some point, he must have got the bug. And I think it had to do with the city actually probably coming through their social housing people to say, look, you know, DERA could actually pull off one of these. And they started to work on a plan for developing a co-op on Alexander Street. And at the same time, the efforts that I was involved in at First United with Lawrence did eventually result in housing projects up the street. The church is still there, and it never was torn down. And I don't know if that's just a gimmick of churches that they say, oh, we'll tear ourselves down. I'm sure that's not the case.
Ken Liotier is a founder of United We Can, a successful recycling depot for binners in the downtown east side. We recorded him on February 25th, giving the first annual Jim Green Memorial Lecture. In this final segment from Ken Liotier's talk, he talks about how he finally got into stable, low-cost housing in the downtown east side, and he also talks about the beginnings of United We Can.
In 1986... I became very sick again. I went back into hospital. I went through a lot of messy procedures and ended up sort of in a circumstance that I was apparently going to live on a tube feeding me, which I didn't know how that was going to work out. But in any event, they said that I wouldn't be allowed out unless I had a place that had its own bathing and washroom facilities. At the time, Jim had been working with DERA on the development of the Four Sisters Co-op, and I got a place in Four Sisters. I moved in before they even had their occupancy permit, sort of haunting the place, eh? And it was my salvation. It was a stable place. I didn't stop drinking right away. That was 1986, but it stabilized my life. And I can't speak loudly enough to how important having a place, a secure place to be, is in stabilizing people's lives here or anywhere. I can remember times being on the street looking up at hotel rooms with, you know, incandescent light bulbs in ceilings and thinking, like, God, that looks good. You know? And it does when you're cold and you're outside and you're lonely and have no place to lay down. So we really, that file, we have so much work to do. I did sober up, though. In 1989, I saw the light. And it was actually shades of that experience in the soup kitchen. And it was just kind of hitting a place where I sort of went native, I guess. I came to believe that I actually had a place in the downtown east side, and I belonged. And when I say I saw the light, it was like that. It was psychedelic. It was like, not like this light, but it was like the light changed. And in hindsight, I think what happened for me is that whatever the emotional baggage that I had been carrying, I was 42 years old, whatever that was, it just became too much. I couldn't carry it anymore. It fell away, and I became a lot lighter, and the world looked a lot brighter physically looked a lot brighter. So when people talk about seeing the light, you know, being born again or whatever, I believe. I have no doubt that, you know, it's quite possible for people to go through amazing psychic changes in their lives. I am an example of that. One of the places that was a touchstone for me during that time was the dugout. The dugout is a simple sort of soup kitchen drop-in center in the downtown east side, not pretentious at all, just a place where people can go and be. And I very much felt a kinship with it. One day I was there, and I also discovered binning big time. I was a dumpster diver, and I was a sober dumpster diver at a time when dumpster diving wasn't the popular sport that it's become today. And actually, people were quite discreet when they go out dumpster diving. They'd sort of hide what they were doing, and I certainly was part of that in the beginnings. But I loved it. And I got to the point that I really didn't give a damn what anybody thought. I was out there digging in the garbage, and it was totally cool. And I was actually making a little bit of money at it. I was putting money under my mattress and hiding it from welfare. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't even smoking in those days. And I'm not smoking today either. But I had cash. Eh? The problem was that there was so much stuff that you couldn't get back through the stores. It wasn't in the deposit refund system. And I had a friend who used to dumpster dive, and we were sitting in the dugout one day, and I was kibitzing with him, and we were grinding in our complaints about the system. And a friend from First United, Barry Morris, heard us, and he said, "Well, you know, if you guys want to do something about this, I think I might know where there's a little bit of cash that you could put towards some event or something that you could do." So we cooked up this scheme to do a one-day event in Victory Square where we would pay people to bring what in those days were non-refundable containers to Victory Square up to the tune of $10 worth. And we put little handbills on all the dumpsters in downtown Vancouver, and we handed them out in the soup lines and the bread lines and the welfare lines, wherever we thought that people might get this. But we had nary a clue of who might know about this or think about this, because it wasn't visible. Binning wasn't visible in those days. Not very visible anyway. On the day of the event, which was like a month later, we arrived at Victory Square with our little strong box with the cash that Barry had brought to us. And it was actually part of a trust fund that Barry had set up with an inheritance. But anyway, we had $1,500. And we arrived at Victory Square, and people were lined up around Victory Square and up Pender Street, up the next street over Homer, I think. And it was like a land office business, eh? We ended up with a huge pile of bottles in Victory Square, and it was like, wow, this is so cool. And people knew how to do it. They knew how to do it, eh? They knew how to sort bottles, how to count bottles, and how to get paid for it. And it was a good day. A good time was had by all. And way more happened out of that event than one could have bought for $1,500, frankly. It was a dead loser as a business, eh? Because these were all non-refundable containers. We had to actually pay to get them hauled to the recycling yard. But we didn't know. We weren't thinking about business. I mean, we just said that there needs to be changes. As it turned out, though, as we talked about it more, because what happened after that is when people would meet one another on the street, they'd say, "Oh, that was such a cool event. We've got to do more of those," eh? And so we worked on that. We planned, well, how could we do? What more could we do? We got some media attention, and at the time, the government changed. I'd written to the previous government saying, you know, what can you do about this refund deposit system? And the minister of the time wrote back, the minister of the environment, and said, "We have a plan. We're going to institute a heavier fine on people that litter, and that should solve it." I mean, didn't get it at all. But they didn't get reelected either. And the government that came in said, "You know what? We're going to have The environment is going to be the centerpiece of our policies, and a cornerstone to our environmental policies is going to be an expanded refund deposit system. And we thought, how easy is that, eh? In fact, it took 8 years. That's a really important piece to think about, you know. 8 years to get changes to a little piece of regulations and statute law, and if anybody's looked at the volumes that govern us, you know, if we want the, you know, if we want to expedite the change we need, you know, 8 years ain't going to cut it, I can tell you.
We've been listening to some excerpts of a talk by Ken Liotier. Ken Liotier is the founder of United We Can, a successful recycling depot for binners in the downtown East Side. He was chosen to give the first annual Jim Green Memorial Lecture. Jim Green was an organizer with the Downtown East Side Residents Association in the 1980s and a champion of low-cost housing in the downtown East Side.
This podcast was produced by the Red Eye Collective in Vancouver, BC. If you live in the Vancouver area and are interested in creating alternative radio with us, we'd love to hear from you. Contact us at redeye@coopradio.org.